Welcome to the Heal, Thrive, Dream podcast, where trauma survivors become healthy thrivers. Each month, we'll feature a theme in the trauma recovery and empowerment field to promote your recovery, healing, and learning how to build dreams. Here's your host, Karen Robinson, transformational coach and therapist.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome back to the Heal, Thrive, Dream podcast. Today, our guest is Dr. Kevin Payne. Dr. Payne is a social psychologist and has a story to tell about multiple sclerosis. He went many, many years prior to being diagnosed. He's going to share that story and also how he recovered enough to live his best life. He is an author. And he also helps other people with their healing. So welcome, Dr. Payne. Please jump in and say whatever I didn't say about you.
Oh, gosh. Well, thank you so much, Karen, for having me here. I appreciate it. I guess there are probably three things that would be relevant about me. One is that, as you mentioned, I'm a social psychologist. I spent 15 years as a professor, left 10 years ago to become a tech entrepreneur. And so I've been doing that. And my current and last company is Your Life Lived Well. And we provide education and technology that supports people improving their quality of life when it's touched by chronic illness. So that's those diagnosed, loved ones and caregivers who too often get forgotten in all of this, and medical health, wellness, and professionals who are too often trained in an acute care model and are sort of left at a loss when they try to effectively treat those of us who are not going to get better and manage their own distress and burnout and all of the other things that come along with the caring professions with these kinds of cases. So that's what I do. The second thing is that I do live with MS. I became symptomatic with MS retrospectively in 1989. So I was in college at the time. And as is often the case with MS, it was misdiagnosed at the beginning, and so I had some balance issues, some fatigue issues, some, parathesias, so I was itching everywhere, and cognitive fog. All of those are things that we're more accomplished at recognizing nowadays.
Right.
And I got really down and confused about the whole thing and pretty depressed. And so when I went to the physician, he took one look at a college student in a demanding academic program with squishy symptoms and said, "Oh, you're dealing with major depression." And he sent me off to a psychiatrist who confirmed that diagnosis and put me on some drugs, and those didn't work, and the next ones didn't work, and the next ones didn't work. So they tagged me as treatment resistant, and that was just kind of where it was. I would have these these weird spells every few years as the relapsing remitting MS came and went, and I would just kind of chalk it up to, well, this is how it expresses, whatever this depression thing is expresses in me. And of course, depression runs in my family, so, I thought maybe that's all there is to it. But what we also didn't realize at that time was that autoimmune conditions run in my family as well. And nobody knew back then that MS is an autoimmune condition. So that was my life until 2002, when I woke up one morning and I couldn't feel my left leg below my knee. I thought that was kind of weird. But I thought I'd probably overdone my workout and went on with my life, and a few days was back to normal. And then it was gone again, and then it was back again, and then different parts of my body were disappearing. And then finally, one day, I woke up, and I could feel my right arm and my head but the rest of my body had disappeared. And at that point, my then wife said, you will get this looked at. So I did. And lo and behold, it was multiple sclerosis. So I've had an accurate diagnosis now for 15 years, because it took a while to get there, and some really bad exacerbations, and some of the kind of the laundry list of, I made a list one time of all the MS symptoms that I have experienced at one time or another. It's about 30 of them that I've racked up over this time. And of course, I've always dealing with medical fatigue and chronic pain and, some of the more common ones. When my balance completely goes, my legs freeze up whenever it gets too warm or too cold or too stressed. And so it's pretty typical for MS, which is my way of saying it's not typical at all, because everybody who has MS has a very different set of experiences with it, because it is a snowflake disease.
Right.
The third thing then is that I'm also an inveterate skydiver. Back in 2019, I decided that my way to reclaim some sense of control and hope and agency in my own life was to reclaim a lost childhood dream of becoming a legit skydiver. And in that time, I've figured out a way to jump, even with a wonky neural system, and logged over 600 jumps and gotten all the licenses and a coach rating. And I never thought I was going to be able to do that.
I'm going to say it's probably an uncommon thing for someone with MS to do, with so many various symptoms.
I know of one other active skydiver with multiple sclerosis. That's it. I hope there are others out there. And if so, introduce yourself to me. I'd love to know you.
Yeah. Well, they probably would feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Especially those who, I have a client who was diagnosed in the past year, and it's been a really, really challenging year. She went from a very high functioning executive to being on disability.
Mm-hmm.
So she's struggling, and, and
relentless.
I'm going to have to tell her about you to see if it inspires a couple little grains of hope.
Well, yeah. And please feel free to put her in contact with me if she'd like to talk. So happy
to. Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. So I guess I need to know more, like when you have chronic pain, is it in certain parts of your body? Does it travel? And tell us more about how you do this without breaking your body up more.
So let's talk about the pain first. I haven't had a pain-free day in pretty much most of the 21st century. So it's been long enough that I really don't have a clear memory of what it's like to not have pain. And the pain got really bad, at certain times. And there was a period in my life where I refused opioids because I just didn't want to go there and open up any of those possibilities in my life. So I was popping ibuprofen like M&Ms. I mean, 20, 24 ibuprofens in a day. And yeah, it was really awful. And I knew that I couldn't do that forever, and I'd already been doing it way too long because, we got the kidney damage issues and all those things that we have to worry about. So I turned to meditation and exercise to be my primary tools that I used to handle my pain. And through retraining my brain over the years, so like at the worst part for those years of my life, day in and day out, if I were asked to share my pain level on like a standard 10-point pain scale, 11-point, I would have said a 6 or an 8, you know, every day. So enough that it is really getting in the way of my life. Now, my condition hasn't changed, but today I will generally give you a 1 to 3 as a rating. So it's there. Sometimes it's annoying, but I can function through it.
And that's basically from retraining your body to the pain. The pain intensity has gone down because of the meditation and stuff. Okay. Yeah, she's actively working on that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it's one of those things that people really, they have a difficult time believing that it works, but but there's study after study after study now that have been racked up in especially the last 20 years that tell us that cognitive reframing really, really works for pain. And you know, I am just but one example of living proof of this. So, you know, that's really crucial. The second thing you're asking about, well, how can I skydive and do that? Now, one of my big challenges skydiving was that I typically can't feel my legs below my knees.
Right.
And I have to understand where my legs are in space, because if you are trying to skydive and your legs are a kilter, then you go into these terrifying spins, right? And you're just careening and tumbling through the sky because you can't produce an air surface that's going to keep you stable. So when I went back to skydive, now I had started the training back in the 90s when I was working on my doctorate because I really wanted to do that. And then life got in the way. Finishing education, kids, career, you know, and then finally it was health. And I got to a point with my MS that I one day, and this was, you know, I'd been mowing the lawn and I had accidentally overheated myself and I ended up passed out from the pain and paralyzed in the front lawn. And when I came to, I'm looking up at the sky and I'm thinking, gosh, what a beautiful day for skydiving. And then I laughed at myself and said, you know, I'm paralyzed here. I am never going to skydive again. And I gave up on it. So then a handful of years later, my son, who was then a teenager, and he was a kind of a smart alecky teenager, like you would expect. One day he said to me, Dad, you really suck at doing things for yourself. And on the one hand, I knew he was right because I had gotten pretty bad at it. In my head, I'm thinking, well, I used to do pretty well at that. And of course, on the other hand, it was kind of crushing to hear that as well. So I resolved at that point, you know, I'd come to a place in my life where I could not see a future for myself that I was interested in experiencing. They're just, you know, I couldn't make my body, and especially for me, because I'd had a really bad exacerbation that was a right frontal temporal exacerbation. And you know what kind of damage that does. So I was having difficulty with cognition and emotional regulation and processing social cues and, you know, all those things. Basically, a symptom list that reads very much like dementia. And so I was at a loss and I didn't know a way forward. So I thought, you know, I'm going to give myself one more chance to get a win. And I need to do something that is completely new to me, that is a different kind of challenge that forces me to humbly approach my capabilities again and to relearn from something from the ground up.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to reclaim the joy that I knew lived on the other side of the fear in skydiving. Because it really does. The fear is on the inside of the door. You go through the door, and it is the most amazing, wonderful, joyful, peaceful, mindful, in this moment experience you can imagine. And so I knew I wanted to try that and to find that again, because I hadn't done anything, as my son reminded me, I hadn't done anything for myself in well over a decade, because I had gotten lost from doing that. And so I did. I went back in 2019, and at first I didn't tell them that I had multiple sclerosis, because I'd logged about 13 jumps before I came back in 2019, you know, years before. So I knew something of what I was in for. So I redid the training, redid it, and I'd go up, and I was having these jumps where it was really difficult for me to control my legs, as you can imagine. And so a few jumps in, by this time I had demonstrated that I could get stable and I could pull on time and I could land myself safely. So once I'd done that, I said, I'm there doing a post-jump debrief with one of the instructors. And she said, and she's had thousands of jumps. And she sat down across from me, still a little wild-eyed. And she said, you know, that's the most terrifying skydive I've ever been on. And so I explained, and she said, what's going on with your legs? And I said, well, I can't feel them below my knees. I have multiple sclerosis. Yeah. And she was like, huh? She's like, did you hurt yourself? What did you do? And so I explained how my MS affected me, and was like, wow. So everybody, you know, at the drop zone, all of the instructors and all of the other skydivers really rallied around me and helped me figure out ways. And it took a lot of extra work on the ground. I had to go to the vertical wind tunnel where I could spend a lot of time floating there with an instructor right there holding onto my leg saying, this is exactly how it needs to be when you're trying to do this. And so I learned to adapt. I learned to understand that even though I couldn't feel where my leg was, I could feel the tension in the tendons behind my knee, because I did have that. So I learned to understand where my leg was there. I learned to stand up a landing, not because I could feel when my feet touched the ground, but I could feel the pressure on my knees. So by creatively adapting, I managed to do that. Now, most people, when they get their first license in skydiving, is called your A license, and it takes 25 jumps, and that's what people take. It took me 47 jumps to get my A license. But then once that happened, I logged another 100 jumps or so in 2019, and then in 2020, I set myself a bigger goal. I said, I'm going to cross 500 before the end of the year, and I am going to log better than one jump a day for all of 2020. Because it was not only about reclaiming that dream and becoming, you know, a competent skydiver, a legitimate skydiver with all the licenses, and, you know, 500 jumps is kind of a milestone in the sport. That's when you're eligible for all the licenses. That's when you're eligible for professional ratings. I picked up a coach rating along the way, and it wasn't just about that. It was about the first thing they tell you when you get diagnosed with MS is avoid stress. Mm. And I'm like, that's no way to live. The correct advice is learn to reframe stress. And so I wanted to, and this is, you know, a massive topic in the book. You know, it's about, because I think that we just fundamentally have a lot of mistaken ideas that are out there surrounding stress and fear and anxiety and depression and grief and trauma and, you know, all of that.
Giving up too soon on dreams.
Yeah, exactly. And giving up too soon. So by doing that, what I was telling myself was that every day I'm going to trip my acute stress response. I'm going to dial it up to 11 and then literally have to save myself every day. And I'm going to keep doing that and keep doing that and keep flinging my body at the earth until I figure this out. And so that's what I did in 2020. It was an extreme version of exposure therapy.
I would say
what I was doing.
But on steroids.
Yeah, but that was my solution because I wanted to be intimately able to be comfortable and fine because, you know, I call it the edge in the book. And it's what we have to understand is, yes, on one side of the edge, there's terror and overwhelm and trauma and all of those things. But just on the other side of the edge are some of the human experiences we value the most, where we are challenging ourselves and growing. And if we pull back so far that we're never going to be distressed, then we're also not going to experience the growth-inducing eustress that's on the side of the edge that we can influence. So I wanted to be extremely comfortable on the edge because my life with my MS pushes me to edges others don't see every day.
And if you're going to live on the edge, you might as well have some fun.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And it can be overwhelming because, you know, when we live with a chronic illness, so often it robs us of our sense of agency. Mm-hmm. And we know that, you know, if you live with a condition like MS, essentially what happens is your body is presenting with you with a random schedule of reinforcement. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it works. And that can be so discouraging and so disheartening. And we know that learned helplessness comes out of that. And even though I knew all the research, I was still experiencing those things. And so I had to figure out a way to live my way through it and develop new tools for the demands that my condition was continually placing me in. Mm-hmm.
So when you're not in the sky and you're on earth on your daily life, do you use a walker or cane, anything to help you with mobility?
I generally only have to use a cane when I'm tired. I really, really try to time everything so that I'm back home and can rest before I've hit that limit. I mean, occasionally I mistime it and my legs will stop working. And so I always try to have a place where I know I can sit someplace and I can cool off or warm up, whatever's necessary, and rest and let myself recover a little bit. But for the most part, nobody would recognize external signs of my MS. And partially that's because I carefully curate what people see. And partly that's because when I'm functioning okay, my legs tend to work. I just don't tend to feel them.
I see. Okay.
So I've got a little bit different set of nerves that are being damaged. But again, I mean, they can go spastic, they can go weak, and my arms can do that as well.
So you have learned how to navigate your symptoms. So do you still get surprised sometimes when you have a symptom? Do you still get new symptoms, or you've adapted to the symptoms?
Yeah, I haven't had a wholly brand new symptom in almost 10 years, but that doesn't mean that they don't come and go surprisingly, right? So, but I haven't had, and truthfully, there are not too many symptoms on the list with MS that I haven't already had at some time or another. So I don't know what new they can do, but I don't want to experience it.
Is being diagnosed with MS the largest trauma that you've had in your life, or have there been others?
Gosh, you know, I talk about this in the book. In the book, the book is 2/3 science wrapped in 1/3 memoir. So I tell them my story. And you know, it, in many ways, it was more traumatic for me to go through a decade of supporting a wife with an advanced cancer than it was my own stuff. I also, in my misspent youth, I mean, I've been, you know, I've gone through a lot of experiences that many people would consider traumatic. I've had 3 car accidents that should have killed me. I've had guns drawn on me 6 times in my life. There are a bunch of them in there. But the thing that was most traumatic to me were the cognitive exacerbations to my MS. Because I've always been a brain guy. That's how I've always made my living. That's how I've always done what I need to do in the world. And so the physical limitations can sometimes really be frustrating. But cognitive limitations can be just devastating. You know, as part of an exacerbation a few years ago, I was dealing with a level of dyscalculia. Now, I'm a math guy. I taught mathematics and statistics, you know, mathematical methods and statistics at an undergraduate and graduate level for 15 years. So it's something that's really comfortable to me. But to have a point in my life where I was looking at data, I was looking at equations, and it wasn't just naturally popping up to me like it normally was, that was so discouraging that it was like having to reframe my entire identity.
Would it be fair to say that even though you know it's not logical, but would you say you felt stupid?
Oh yeah. I mean, I have a primal brain just like everybody else. Sometimes mm-hmm. it hijacks during those circumstances. And certainly it makes me feel worthless. Mm-hmm. And you know, I have been through times in my life where people that I love the most looked me square in the eye, and I was going through my worst times, and told, you know, they told me, "You are worthless." Direct quote. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, on the one hand, I know. And on the other hand, I'm still in here. I'm still trying. I'm still doing the best that I can in this moment.
Right. What's your encouragement or advice to other people? You know, because a lot of trauma survivors get that message a lot, either directly or indirectly through the abuse they endure. How do you suggest people overcome that?
You know, I think the first thing that you have to understand, and the way I frame the idea of trauma in my book, is about this idea of the edge and how, so if you're over a little bit, then that's overwhelm. But if you're over a lot, that becomes traumatic, because what people have to understand is, yeah, okay, you quote unquote failed at handling this thing. But the thing you have to understand is there's no reason why you should have succeeded. Nothing in life prepares us or trains us for these things that become traumatic, no matter what they are. It's a profound injury. And that's how we need to see trauma. Emotional trauma, cognitive trauma, behavioral trauma, social trauma. It's the same thing as physical trauma. It's when your emotions or your experience are presented with something, with some force that is so overwhelmingly awful that you are not prepared to deal with that level of suckage.
Suckage. Did you make that word up?
Yeah, I throw weird words. I like to neologize. Creating new words is fun. Mm-hmm. But it's true. It's so the very, very, very first thing we have to understand is, even if it's someone else that you know and they have gone through something similar and weren't quote unquote traumatized about it, it's not a contest. It's never a contest.
Right.
You have just simply not been in the circumstances in your life to this point to build those muscles in that way. That's all. And so you've been injured. And just like a physical injury needs appropriate care and support and rest and rehabilitation, our emotions and our thoughts and all of that are the same thing. It's the very same thing. So you have got to not feel inadequate.
What I heard was a lot of slander, the direction towards like self-compassion.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to have trauma, but then to have these horrible feelings or thoughts about yourself afterwards, it's like, well, you didn't do that trauma to yourself, you know?
No, so, no. And you have got to be kind to yourself to allow yourself the space to do that healing.
Right.
And so I just, you know, this is something that really gets me. So I like to ask people to ask themselves, if you were in a relationship with you and you treated yourself and somebody else treated you the way you treat yourself, would you stay in that relationship?
Right. Run for the hills.
Most of us have such a dysfunctional relationship with ourselves.
Yes, we do.
And you have to have a relationship with ourselves. And so be kind. Be patient.
Mm-hmm. Do you have that in your book?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. It's like, it all starts there.
Can you hold up your book for those watching the podcast on YouTube?
Sure.
Your Life Lived Well. Mm-hmm. Okay. And is it on Amazon?
It'll be out February 7th. There's a 100-page preview right now available on yourlifelivedwell.co. The subtitle is The Science of Crafting a Good Life Under Chronic Distress, Pain, and Illness. And this picture on the front, it took us 8 jumps over 6 weeks to get this image.
Wow.
And I wanted exactly that image because this image tells the story of the entire book. And here's what it is. If you are able to see here, I'm on my belly heading to Earth at 120 miles an hour. And I've got my hands palm down up to my forehead. And I'm about ready to sweep my arms out really wide in skydiving. That's called the wave off. That is the signal that says, I am about to take action to save myself. Everybody else in my airspace needs to be warned. And so at the moment that this picture was taken, it was 5,000 feet above the Earth. I was headed to the Earth at 120 miles an hour. That means that my life expectancy at this point was 27 seconds. If I did nothing, I would die 27 seconds later, but I didn't. I chose to wave off and deploy my parachute and take the action to save myself. And that's the mentality that I want people to enter the book with. When you take up this book, you are in that same position. You are about to take action to save yourself. And I know this because I've done it myself. I do it myself every day. It's not a one-time thing. I got to keep doing it every single day. and everybody else can too. And it's not about one way to do it. It's about giving people the tools so that they can figure out the way that's going to work for them.
What a powerful message. Tell us one more time when it's going to be released.
It's out February 7th. And if you sign up, at yourlifelivedwell.co, you can get 100 pages now for free. And we will let you know everywhere that it is whenever it hits the market on the 7th.
Okay. Awesome. So I do have one more final question. And of course, if you have anything else inspirational to share, we would love that. Other than your book, which sounds pretty powerful, do you have I love books, and you told me too that you have a very large library before we started our podcast. Do you have a favorite book that really kind of jazzes you up?
You know, I am such a geek that the ones that really jazz me up are like really deep into my field. And I don't know if they would have a lot of general appeal, but like, for example, there's one book, Kurt Levine, who was one of the greats of psychology, wrote a book called The Principles of Topological Psychology. And this is 80 years ago now, almost. And I reread that book every year.
Is that good?
Because I find it that profound. Yes. And So, you know, there's something like that. James Gleick wrote a book back in 89 that was a popular press book called Chaos, Making of a New Science. And it was about the then burgeoning field of chaos theory and fractals and that sort of thing. And it's a real game changer. I love, you know, the classic Gödel, Escher, Bach, which is, just a wonderful meditation on the complexity of mind and human experience. Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. There's
See,
a great one.
I didn't
one
like that from, book.
I love that one. But then, there were way too many parallels, but personally, between me and Persic. And so that resonated. So, yeah, I mean, but my books are kind of geeky, kind of weird. And that's okay. That's why there are millions of books in the library, because there's something
right
for all of us.
That's right. Well, the first two books sounded fascinating, you know, because it's my field as well. But Okay. Well, Kevin, we really appreciate your time with us. I feel that you being here will definitely inspire, you know, the few people that will come by and listen. You know,
I
think
so.
You have a strong message for them. Okay.
Well, I am delighted to have spent this time with you, Karen, and thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you as well.
Thank you for listening in today. Please join us next week, same day and time. Also, I would love for you to check out my website, healthrivedream.com.